Welcome to Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips, a color-conscious podcast about politics. I'm your host, Steve Phillips, and when I was a young man, one of my political heroes was Ron Dellums, the congressman from the East Bay of California. He was a champion for peace and justice in Congress, and he introduced the bill to impose sanctions on the racist nation of South Africa for 14 years in a row, until eventually sanctions actually did pass in 1986, shocking the country and the world and accelerating the process toward ending apartheid and freeing Nelson Mandela and bringing democracy to that nation. During the 1980s, I met and got to know Barbara Lee as we both worked on Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign before she succeeded Dellums in Congress representing that seat. And Barbara distinguished herself and the importance of that specific congressional seat in her solitary stand against the rush to war in 2001, as millions of progressive people across the country said, "Barbara Lee speaks for me." That historic and seminal congressional seat is being vacated by Barbara, and those are mighty big shoes to fill. Fortunately for progressive people around the world, the leading candidate to succeed Barbara is herself an incredible social justice leader who will carry on the struggle to remake this world. I'm absolutely delighted to be joined on today's podcast by that person. Very much looking forward to this conversation. And I'm joined as always by my co-host, Charlene Chang. Hi, Charlene. How are you? And do you want to introduce our guest?
Hey, Steve. I'm doing so great today. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to talk to our guest today. She's just really one of my favorite people, really somebody in the world who I admire so much. And to get to talk to her today is just both such an honor and such a joy. And so with that, I want to introduce Latifah Simon. She's a nationally recognized advocate for civil rights and racial justice in Oakland and the Bay Area. She's currently running to replace Representative Barbara Lee in Congress. In 2016, following the police murder of Oscar Grant, Latifah was elected to the Bay Area Rapid Transit Board of Directors, or as we call it here in the Bay, BART. And she served as president of that board. And in 2005, she was tapped by then San Francisco DA Kamala Harris to spearhead Back on Track, which was the city's first youth anti-recidivism program. At the tender age of 26, Latifah became the youngest woman ever to receive a MacArthur Genius Fellowship. So we got a real certified genius in the house today in recognition of her work as executive director of the Young Women's Freedom Center. And in 2020, she was appointed a senior advisor on police reform for California Governor Gavin Newsom. Latifah has served on numerous boards and committees and has won lots and lots like BOKU awards, including California State Assembly's Woman of the Year in 2005. And I just want to say, I can't wait to have my t-shirt. The district she's running for is the district I live in. And I can't wait to have one that says Latifah in the house. So we are so glad to have same. You can have that one for free. We got Latifah in the house right here. And I'm just so stoked. And this is our third time on our podcast, three times a charm. We love her so much. And Latifah, welcome. So, so happy to have you here today.
I am so happy. Literally, it was like coming through the storm, figuratively and literally, to get to you guys because, well, I listen to this podcast all the time. And Uncle Steve, as many of us call him, young people of color. I'm not that young anymore, but I once was young. And we just really, really love what y'all are doing. We love the fact that everything with this podcast and about what Steve, your nomenclature is about, is making sure that we're not ahistorical when we're approaching this thing called politics and justice. So I'm super excited to have this conversation with y'all today.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And so I do want to talk about that a little bit in terms of the place, like of electoral politics and running for office, right? So that you, just for our listeners' background, the primary was earlier this month, and you were the top vote getter, getting 56% of the vote.
Yeah.
In the seat that Barbara had represented for 26 years. One of the most multiracial and progressive areas in the country. So I talked about its historical lineage of who's represented it. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about, because you connected with Barbara recently in terms of she literally handed you a baton in terms of carrying on. But really, firstly, because your work started really with, working with, young women and with girls and then moving into the local office. Not a lot of people who are social justice activists see electoral politics as a sphere for doing that kind of work. So can you talk a bit about your decision to run for office in the first place, and then the decision to run for this congressional seat?
Uncle Steve, thank you for the question. First of all, the last couple of weeks have been amazing because I've actually gotten to sleep at like 11 o'clock. I decided to run almost a year ago. I launched my campaign on February 28th, and I think I called you February 27th saying like, Uncle, I'm running. This is crazy. And for those of you who don't know, Steve has trained and mentored a lot of young people to get into politics. And you would always say, even after people give, keep calling. So that's, I'm not asking for none. I just want to let you know I'm calling Steve like every other week. Like, hey, Steve. because you also say in your text that politics cannot be transactional. That we are building not only coalitions, we are building another way of being by saying we are doing this thing to take everyone with us. And I believe that. And a lot of that came from you. So just so you know, next time you call, listen to my message because I'm just giving you good news. I kind of can't believe where we are. You know, I didn't quit my job to run for office. I got into philanthropy after so many years of being on the other side of the table, begging people to see the humanity of movement leaders, that what we could do with $25,000 could be more than government could do with $3 million. And I, you know, so much of my work from leading organizations to running the reentry unit in a DA's office to being a non-lawyer, you remember that, running the lawyers committee to shift their strategies to actually be movement lawyers and not just litigators with a lofty idea of what is possible, which is important, but the hood needs lawyers. Every institution that I have entered, I've wanted to shift it to meet really the needs of folks who deserve material conditions to be shifted in community. So the idea to run for the BART board, you know, and it was a position that only kind of politicos knew about. After the death, murder of Oscar Grant, you know, us as organizers being in that BART board meeting every other week, demanding that the BART do something about these officers, the chief, we had no oversight commission with Barrier Rapid Transit that has its own police department, by the way. You know, after my husband died and I lost everything, and I will never forget, we were actually in treatment in Washington, in the state of Washington, when we learned that Meserly, the man, the cop who killed Oscar, was actually going to face charges. And we talked about it. We talked about it. Kevin's no longer with us, but I remember our conversation so keenly. One, he said, I will never ride BART again, meaning that I'm not going to trust this public institution with my life. And secondly, they got him. They got him. So for too long did Black men, did people of color in this country almost internalize the fact that when we are done wrong by the state, the folks that are supposed to protect us, we just knew that life would go on as planned, that no one would be held accountable. So the Meserly trial for us at that time was so important. After Kevin died, and I'm back on public transit as a transit dependent, disabled woman, legally blind woman, it was so much of those conversations when we were in treatment that were bubbling in my throat, that were bubbling in my chest, that I had lost everything and I needed to do something that was outside of my comfort zone. I've been fighting for justice. I've been fighting for Kevin. I've been fighting for my babies. But, you know, the transit space was now a space I was re-entering as a consumer, having a husband even on his damn near deathbed was driving us to his own appointments. I had lost everything fighting for his life, had a ton of debt, almost $1 million worth of debt, going all over the country seeking a cure for an incurable cancer. And for the last 7 years, what I have seen, even in this, you know, what many would say a minuscule board that hosts a $2.4 billion budget, folks don't get it. But what I've been able to do and see and learn and experience is that I can whip votes to change the lived experience of people in this county. So, you know, Uncle, from decreasing the youth fare to reorganizing how our police department works. You remember when I was campaigning for an ambassador force. Now it's like everybody wants ambassadors. People laughed at me. But I knew that people who were poor, who were having the worst days of their lives, they deserved an intervention that didn't include a gun and a badge, right? We actually have to get folks in situations where they can get care and not be criminalized, while law enforcement is extremely important to the conversations about how we move. And I've done that. You know, I've done accountability, affordability, and accessibility work So when Miss Lee called me and just told me she was running for the United States Senate and reminded me that when I was in her class, she was my professor at Mills, where I used to bring my oldest daughter on the weekends to that five-hour class that Barbara would fly out to every Friday night so she could teach on Saturdays. She reminded me, she said, Latifah, you remember that? Well, I said one day I would retire from the House, and I asked the students in the class, who would run for Congress? She reminded me that I raised my hand. While it was a facetious conversation, she didn't endorse me at that time. She didn't say, you need to run. She said, I think you need to talk to your family that these positions don't come by. You're a fighter. They don't come by but once in a lifetime. So that's why I'm running. And I worked hard, harder than I think I've ever worked in my life, with a day job and a 12-year-old and trying to marry my daughter off. And my oldest was completing law school. And I said, this is actually possible. This is possible. And I called folks who were thought of to be candidates in this race. And I said, will you support me? So no, I didn't clear the field. I had developed coalition years prior with Libby Schaff and Nancy Skinner and Buffy Wicks and Mia Bonta. We didn't agree on everything politically, but we had developed a sisterhood as women in politics. And so here I am. I did win 56% of the vote in a 9-person race, which folks have told me is like very, very odd. We've got a lot of coalition. This seat, as per your intro, should not be held by a liberal Democrat. We need someone like Barbara, you know, like Mr. Dellums, who's going to put their whole life on the line for our people. So I don't really have a choice. I'm going to do that work. I got to do it. We deserve it. We deserve all that's been put into me, all the political education, all the resourcing, all the different spaces that I've been in, from the ground to prisons to philanthropy to local government. I do believe I'm suited to fight those Republicans and some of the Democrats.
That's right. And I'm just so glad that to hear you. Thank you, first of all the stories about that, the scene that you painted about that moment where your husband was having to drive himself, and then him saying that he's not going to take BART again. And yet, you know, after he passed, you being someone, again, I don't know if listeners heard this because you said it so quickly, but you are legally blind. And so you're transit dependent. And for you and many, it is not an option to not take public transit. And you chose to fight for people to have the best possible transit and safety experience as possible in our community. And so I just really want to make that really clear to listeners and reiterate, and just you helping to connect the dots with telling that story just really helped me, even though you've told me that I've heard that story from you before, just really brought it home again, like why that was so meaningful for you. And that was your entryway into becoming a public servant. And again, so District 12 is a district that you're running for, and it's a district that I live in, by the way, and I'm real proud resident of it and just thrilled. It is the second bluest House district in the country, according to the Cook Political Report. And I wanted to let people know again that some of your key endorsements have come from, you know, pretty significant endorsers. Governor Newsom, obviously, you mentioned, you know, Rep Lee, and State Attorney Rob Bonta. You've also been endorsed by Emily's List, these, you know, big organizations that endorse, you know, and have very significant winning records of those who they've backed. Emily's List, Higher Heights for America, which backs African-American women candidates, and labor groups such as California Working Families Party and SEIU. As Steve mentioned, and you mentioned, you gained 56% of the vote in the primary earlier this month. That you had said was odd, but when you were saying about your history of how much work you put in, and you are one of the hardest working people I know, I don't even know how you do it. But yes, you know, you got that 56% of the vote. By the way, Democratic Jennifer Tran came in second with the most votes at 15%. So my question is, how are you and your team then gearing up for the general election?
You can't really take anything for granted, ever. Our lives are really on the line in this election. I have, over the last, you know, 5 days, you know, I've done 16 events and I've been working on my day job in the morning and at night. I believe that we will win, but so much of how I'm looking at this election is, both locally and nationally, is about both my on the ground work here to convince us to turn out for my race, but also for the Democratic Party and for local races here. So, you know, I just met with the Deltas and they had a big, huge convening. It was like 1,000 people in the room. And these are Black women who are committed to social action. It's a C3. But for me, what is so important is that everywhere I am, especially locally, like, and I want to be out every single day on the ground at, you know, at doors, at community meetings. I am tabling tomorrow at the flea market. I hope it doesn't rain. To talk about the development opportunities in South Berkeley for Black people who have been, you know, pushed out for the last 50 years. I have like so many messages, but one of the messages that I have for folks who are involved in politics is that we have a sinister beast that is coming from, again, the post-Trump administration, from the Trump campaign, but also in the revert of progressivism in the Bay Area. Like, we are going to become Orange County very, very soon. That this idea that we can revert back, you know, to even my good friends who are in government, to a 1980s failed policy strategy about how we deal with poverty and addiction and crime. I was at the Niagara Movement dinner the other night, and there were some of those folks in the audience, and it's like, we don't have to tear each other apart. We just actually have to be very honest with each other. You're wrong. We're gonna love each other, but you're wrong. So for me, it is continuing to be steadfast, even in this moment of what I modern, sort of the modernization of progressivism in the Bay Area, knowing that we have big fights to fight in DC, we know what those are. And also we have a politic to keep center here in the Bay Area. We know real strategies to solve these old problems. We just gotta curtail our folks to get in line to do the right thing. So I am gonna have an amazing ground game. I still have endorsements to get. And you know, I have another 500,000 people to talk to. So yes, I'm going to win. I need to support, you know, again, the Biden-Harris campaign. There are campaigns in red and purple states that I promised Leader Jeffries that I was going to be on the ground. You know, I met with him. He gave me an hour of his time a couple of weeks ago and asked my adult daughter to join the meeting. His staff called me and said, we hear you have a daughter in D.C. I'm making relationships in D.C. so that my transition with Ms. Lee's office is amazing. I'm working hard because our people deserve it, right? Our people deserve it. We need to be in the House.
You, before we got started, you were getting ready to tell us a story about how you had a couple of experiences on the campaign.
Well, just today. So I'm going to be very transparent. I had a wonderful meeting with a group called HLC. I'm forgetting what the acronym is, but it's a consortium of the biggest healthcare providers in this country. And, you know, I've been clear that I'm not taking resources from the executives of healthcare industry because of what I've seen. And there's another fight that I want to fight. So I told my campaign manager, can you make sure you email her before that? I don't want their money or their endorsements. We got on the phone. And again, you know, she was very clear. We're not supporting single payer or Medicare for all. But I was like, what are you supporting? I want to be an operator. I want to get shit done. I don't need to be on, you know, MSNBC every night. So she told me about their bill package. I said, okay, clearly we're not on some mountaintop unity stuff, but where can I work with you, actually? They talked about a few immigration bills they're trying to push through to make sure that folks who are pushing through their asylum status, who are LVNs, MAs, and even physicians actually have a place in this country because we have a shortage. We are going to disagree on so many things, but I just found so much comfort in, I am going, bringing my 12-year-old. I'm a renter. I have no plans. I don't know where I'm going to live. I have 4 suits. But what I do know is that from what I've been through, I just buried Kevin's mother just a few months ago. I was her sole caretaker. And I went through all of her accordions and I found no life insurance. And like, we scraped some money to bury her pretty quickly, our church and our community. And I'm just like, in the last couple of weeks, she had to be in a rehab facility, which I learned was a nursing home that used. We deserve so much more. So much more. So that one call just actually really encouraged me to think, like, I can work with institutions that I don't have to agree with fully, but we actually have some common ground, and it's my job to not bifurcate myself into a corner. I know who I am. I've been a radical pragmatist since my days running the Youngest Freedom Center, and I had to win things for my sisters. That's what I'm going to do in Congress, but with an elevated understanding of what's at stake. But the second meeting I had today, I'm not going to say no names, but it's a brother that has not been nice to me online and is a real serious sort of, I called him a provocateur. And we sat down and we had some gumbo at Brenda's. And I was like, you know, tell me where we actually disagree. On values is one, strategy is another. Because you can't tell me someone who is in the work dishing on other people of color who are in politics. We all want a safer Oakland. We all want kids. I want to be able to, for Layla to play across the street at the park and I just watch her. We're not there yet, right? We all want folks to have stuff to eat. We all, if you sprain your ankle, you want to go get a cast. My job is to hold my politic, but also to bring in where possible, but also, what is it? You talk a lot online. What is it? We're now going to be meeting every other week. We're going to fight, and that's okay. When I ran the Young Women's Freedom Center, I was in the Tenderloin every single day, not just knocking on doors to give out referrals, but also confronting men who were exploiting the women that I was organizing with. And Barbara is amazing. She's telling me, sister, you know, you have to come in with your scarf and your suit. I'm like, okay. I got a lot to learn, but I'm a fighter. I'm a fighter, and I actually need those who I'm fighting against to be the closest to me. I mean, it's Alinskyite organizing at its very best. So I owe that to my people, not just to hang around the choir. The choir is singing. The piano may be off tune, but I owe it to my folks to be able to confront folks who don't believe that we are human and that we deserve some of the most basic of rights. And not in a way that pushes them further. I do want to go to West Virginia to talk to mothers who can't get reproductive health care, or the babies that they do have are going to school with bloody noses because they live in sacrifice zones. That's the work that I'm supposed to do at this point in my life, to be able to bring and whip votes so that our folks can actually have a better life.
Shifting just slightly, Latifa, wanting to kind of get a sense of, as you think ahead, speaking of getting into conversations with people who may or not agree with you and your long history as an activist coming from, you know, being just such a staunch progressive and a fighter for people. How are you thinking about what's happening in Gaza, the Middle East, and how, you know, how are you thinking about this as a leader in our community and our society who's on her way to having greater platform and a greater voice?
Yeah, right after this call, I'm speaking to a Jewish group who's somewhat upset at me because I have been pretty out about wanting to, continue the legacy of Barbara Lee and Ron Dellums. There's no wavering on that. There's also an acknowledgement on many fronts that if you are an Afghani Jew, you cannot live in Afghanistan. I'm a Muslim, it's Ramadan. I get it. I actually understand the geopolitics of that space. If you are an Iraqi Jew, you have no place to go but the UK, the United States, or Israel. For many folks who are Jewish, not just the Ashkenazi population, they have no place to go. And we have a responsibility as a core democratic republic state to ensure that our resources are going towards just regimes. I have babies. So to me, there's 40,000, what we believe, Hamas operatives in that region, and they have done horrible things. I understand. There are 30,000 people who are dead. And I know that violence doesn't beget violence. And finally, the United States government, the head of states, are saying, this is out of hand. What we knew is there were women on the ground and children and organizers of Jewish faith, of Islamic faith, of Christian faith all over the world saying, we say this is not the way and you will come around. One of the things that Barbara told me is I told her in the beginning, oh my goodness, this is really intense at the very beginning of the conflict. She said, stand on the corner alone. People will come your way. If you are always standing on the right side of history and peace, not looking through rose-colored glasses, understand what's happening in Ukraine, understand what's happening in Haiti. But somebody needs to stand on the corner by themselves and say, this is not the way. You don't gain global dominance or peace through war. And it's not a position that is ill-informed. It is one that carries a tradition, not only in this seat, but some of the leaders that we know, if they were still here, the ones that we celebrate on January 15th, Mr. King, Dr. King, and others who would purport the exact same lexicon. We can't do what we're doing. I'm very clear about that. That's not going to make a lot of people happy. But at the end of the day, when I leave this life, I will be so, so thankful that I took the position that I took.
And I just want to, well, thank you for that and to lift up for our audience that is the tradition and that is the legacy and the lineage of this seat. Ron Dellums for 14 years in a row. I mean, it's hard to imagine that there was a, you know, officially racist state in South Africa that the United States was in lockstep with for decades. And it was not politically popular and could not move forward politically. But for 14 years, Ron Dellums called for the United States to take the right moral stand on that issue. Barbara Lee singularly, alone, cast the ballot against the rush to war. And so that is the tradition. And so I just want to lift that up in terms of what the importance of this seat is to the whole country, frankly, mm-hmm. the whole world, is to have a voice who can articulate those pieces. So we know you need to go and to carry that message forward. So we're going to try to wrap this up. But I just want to ask you one more question. I think what I kind of end on actually quite a fairly deeply personal note. And so you had mentioned losing Kevin and that, as you know, and our listeners know, I lost Susan. And first, I just want to say thank you to you for your friendship and your support, and you reached out. And also, I don't think I've ever said this to you before, that you modeled how to handle or how to deal with a loved one reaching the end of their journey. And I learned a lot from it. And so I don't think I've ever said that. I wanted to share that with you. And then here you are now moving forward and thriving and taking on this leadership. So I wonder if we could wrap, maybe you could just share a little bit of what helped you be able to put yourself back together and move back out and take on enough leadership.
Damn it, Steve. I was like, I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to do it.
Seriously.
And I was just going to say, this is the year where I haven't cried as much. It's been 10 years. And like, I met the person, actually, many folks know that Kamala introduced Kevin and I, who was a Black journalist, and she actually married us, and she also eulogized him. And it's, I found my person and I got him. Like, you got your love. We got them for this time. And for whatever, I'm still trying to figure out the lesson of my creator. You took us through this thing that was so, when you deal with cancer, it is just so awful, but also those moments that are so sweet. And it's been 10 years and I don't cry as much now. And what I still do sometimes, because I'm just, when I think back, I'm like rattled by, we went through that. Mm. He's gone. He's still gone. Mm-hmm. This is not just a big fight.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't exist in human form. But I'm going to tell you this. I actually believe in God more since he's been gone than I did when he was alive, because something has been holding me so tightly. And I just physically, and I know sometimes you physically feel some stuff and you're like, are the windows closed? Like, why is that all on my back? I don't care what your religious background is. You don't have one. When your people who love you go, there are reminders that they're still here all the time. And I'm doing this exact work for Kevin. It's the things that we talked about of like one day doing this thing that I'm doing. And I'm also so hopeful that folks don't have to actually at some point go through what we've gone through, right? Like, we can put a man or woman or sibling on the moon, but we cannot figure out how to make sure that bad cells are not replicating. Come on now. We are going to be, I believe, in the next 15 to 20 years, folks are going to have a very different story than saying goodbye to their loved ones before they're mature. I just have to believe that. And if we fight, and if we make sure that we're putting resources, as Barbara did for HIV, right? When everyone was like, oh, these queer white men and these black women and these trans folks, they're just going to die. You know what Congress was saying? That is their fate. As many folks saw with COVID, folks are just going to die. But now it's all of us who are at risk. Everybody is at risk. What did we do? What was that response? The same thing, you know, I think about when I think about cancer, when I think about homelessness, when I think about the, you know, disparity of wealth, crises happen and we shift and we move to the moment. I was talking to that healthcare executive today and she said, millions of people right now are dealing with what you dealt with Kevin. And I said, and that is devastating. Because the pain that I still feel raising my children, looking every single day at his picture on my mantle, knowing that he died too soon, is a tragedy. And although he's only one, knowing that there are millions right now in hospice and care, fighting for insurance yeses, dealing with the no's, it just makes me want to work harder. Because I saw those little babies go home when, you know, in clinic, when they couldn't get a second stem cell transplant. I saw those parents in the line, you know, at Fred Hutch waiting for the financial specialist to just say yes to the new treatment, to the clinical trial. This is ridiculous. And we all have a similar story. All of us. So I thank you for bringing it up. And we need to do podcast too. Once I get all good on healthcare policy, we're going to do some stuff.
Let's go.
Because I'm going to fight for our people and we're going to win. I believe that or I wouldn't be doing it. People say nothing happens in Congress. They haven't seen Bay Love.
No, Wait till they see.
So we're going to let you go, Latifah. But so how can people keep up with you and how can they support the cause?
Go to our website at latifahsimon.com. That's LATEEFAH Simon.com. And we're on all of the socials. We're going to have a lot of fun organizing our communities. We're going to have a lot of fun legislating. And we're going to have struggle. And in that, we're going to need our big coalition of millions of folks, not just in the Bay, but all over the country, helping us fight for what's right.
Great. And we've been on this journey. And we look forward to continuing it with you.
All right. All right. Stay up, you guys.
Oh, so great to see you, Latifah.
All right. That is all the time we have for today. So glad we were able to connect with Latifah. She was running from and to events, and it's really glad that she made the time to spend with us. It's just always so inspiring and nurturing to be with her. And I want to thank you for listening to Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. Please help us get the word out about this podcast by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts, sharing with your friends, tweeting at Democracy Color and at Steve P. Tweets, and finding us at Democracy in Color on Facebook or Instagram. You can also keep up with all things DEMCO by subscribing to our newsletter at democracyincolor.com. And if you listen to our podcast on iTunes, please leave us a rating and a comment. It helps others to find our show. This podcast is a Democracy in Color production. Our producer is Olivia Parker. Fola Onifade is our staff writer and associate producer. Charlene Chang is our editor and co-host. Special thanks to April Elkier for Quality Check. Recorded virtually with the assistance of the podcast studio, San Francisco. Until next time, keep the faith.